Richard Slotkin is our guest. We were talking about heroic myths and what happens when we lose them.
Yeah, I think the Washington myth became a very pallid...
George Washington.
The George Washington myth became a very pallid and almost contentless myth, I would say, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, because he wasn't a possible figure for us to emulate. He was too good. The issues he was dealing with, independence from England, were not really live issues. We were a world power. We didn't have to fight for our independence in that sense. Interesting that he's coming back now in TV movies. And America is thinking of itself once again as a kind of an underdog, fighting for liberation from some sort of world power, the WTO, perhaps. Lincoln has been more lively for longer because the race issue has been so powerful. But in times of disorder, in times where values are called into doubt and where people, both as individuals and as groups, don't really know what they ought to do next, what direction things ought to be going, you try to vector yourself in history, establish a point in the past, figure out what that means, then get another point. And if you can get those two points together, perhaps you can read a direction out of the past. When you do that, You go into the mythic memory banks and you retell the story in the new terms to see what meaning there might be in it. And that's what I see myself as doing in the fiction. Actually, I do it in my scholarship and in the fiction. In the fiction, I see myself as contributing directly in mythic terms to this revisionist process of changing the myths, renewing the myths. And in the scholarship, I state what the problem is.
The violence and the racism are really predicates. The myths have made it possible for us to rationalize those, to make it possible for us to exercise, to have a coherent view that justifies and rationalizes behaviors that would be a challenge by some objective standard. Talking about the crisis, the mythic muddle, the mythic crisis, are those still the predicates that we're working with, or because that matters? Because if those go away, as many people would argue they should, then we've really got a crisis.
I think the nature of the crisis is that because those two terms are so fundamental, and because we see the exhaustion of their value, then that's why we need a new story.
Fundamental to our culture or to the human?
I guess I do mean to the human, but I mean I need to speak specifically in American terms here, because race means different things in different places. For us, it's the color line. The color line, just in my lifetime, has begun to blur and unravel. It doesn't mean what it used to mean. I don't mean to be a utopian here, but when you think of the distance that our manners have come in one generation, and our laws have come in one generation, it's a very promising development. But culture changes very slowly. Culture is fundamentally conservative. And we've not reconstructed our concept of race in such a way that we can conceive of stories in which there are black and female protagonists on the same scale we can do with whites. And we have not developed stories in which we find some substitute for the role of violence in those mythic renderings of American history. To give you an example, the Western is one of the fundamental ways we have of recapitulating the American past. Can you conceive of a Western that instead of ending with a gunfight, the two guys, the good and evil guys, the black hat and the white hat guy, approach each other down the middle of the street and then sit down with a negotiator to work things out on the basis of compromise? Until you can imagine that as a viable movie,
That somebody would go see
and believe, and that someone would want to repeat, say, wow, that's what a great way to think of that. Let's make another movie just like that. Then you have not dealt with the fundamental structure, which says that the key to historical progress, growth, success, whatever your word is the ability to use violence.
To put this, I think what you're talking about is very central to where we find ourselves. Culture is predicated on these myths. In the absence of an agreed myth, To the extent that that ceases to exist, you cease to have a functional culture.
Yes.
So what you're talking about, if you're, you know, if we have a crisis of myth, we also have a crisis of culture.
Yes. Yeah.
So what is, have you, do you in your research see anything that is moving in to take this the place of it?
I don't see anything. What I see is the variety of new stories that are being articulated in old forms. The way in which, for example, the new wave of Westerns are all non-traditional. Indians are good guys, whites are bad guys.
But you still got the same predicate.
Well, you still got bad guys and good guys and violence.
Yep, you have not changed the fundamental structure of violence, but you have changed some things about race and gender. Science fiction allows you to take, because it's about the future, it's about history that hasn't happened yet, so it's plastic. And we use science fiction to try out ways of projecting a past into the future. It's interesting to me what old elements we choose to project. A lot of the sci-fi things are Westerns, in futuristic Westerns. Some of them are war films, combat films, but World War II combat films where our side is a multiracial, multi-ethnic platoon rather than, you know, Custer's Last Stand, white guys standing off non-white guys.
So we're beginning to deal with the issue of race. Violence is still problematic.
Violence is about power and who gets to use it. And we still see violence as the primary symbol of power in our mythic life. I don't mean to say that we just shoot each other all the time.
Are you talking about Americans? Or are you talking about people?
I'm talking about Americans. Now, every culture has its ways of rationalizing violence. And its mythologies of violence. The distinction I like to make is one of the key distinctions, I think, is that in America, our myths license private individuals to use deadly force, whereas in Europe, the license is a social or group license. And if you think about murderousness, I always laugh when Europeans talk about America as a murderous society, and I say, I'm sorry, didn't you guys have two world wars, a Holocaust and a gulag? But they don't have our murder rate, do they? And our private violence is our thing. That's why I say I have to talk as an American. There are aspects of this problem which are uniquely ours.
If that is the case, because in a way, as I hear you talk about science fiction being working its way forward, in a very real sense, it felt in reading Abe that you were doing that looking back.
Yes.
That in the very act of regenerating the story, bringing it back, that you were trying again to make sense of it differently.
Yes. When you do that, when you do historical fiction, when you do it well or the way I want to do it, you are recovering lost possibilities. The Lincoln in the novel is potentially better and worse than the Lincoln we actually end up with. And what I wanted to show is the potential for both evil doing and also for liberation, which exists in American culture as symbolized by Lincoln. Both of those possibilities are real. In historical fact, only certain of the possibilities got realized. But when we go back and look at the history, in a sense, before it has happened, we imaginatively recover the lost possibility. And because it's the year 2000, not the year 1831, that possibility now becomes a possibility for us. This Lincoln is a hero who potentially promises a different sort of liberation from racism than the real Lincoln.
And in
offered.
A sense, you can then carry that forward, that if you yes. think differently about our central icon, then perhaps you can begin to shape stories differently.
Yes.
And you don't have a sense of doom that we must always
That's
be
right.
caught in our same mistakes. Is that
That's
it?
That's right. That's right.
And one of the benefits of myths is you can learn from them. If they're vital myths, if they're
yes.
alive, then they have instructive potential
yes.
in a culture.
You can only learn, though, by if you engage actively in the struggle of trying to retell them in terms that incorporate the new things you've learned since the old myth was told.
That's very interesting, because in the old days, well, used to be we'd sit around and tell our myths. That has been
preempted really.
by popular media, the movies mm-hmm. and television, whatever.
But people retell those stories to each other.
Right. Yes.
I mean, you hear kids talking in movies to each other.
You made a striking point referencing an article in Foreign Affairs in the, I think, early 80s about the thrust of it was that in the absence of these unifying myths, that you end up with a politics that is essentially parochial. It is a politics of me. It is a politics of special interest groups. And what I think you're pointing toward is, this was in the 80s, and I can't remember the author, but it looked like a very accurate description of the current state of politics. Yeah,
William McNeil, the crisis of public myth, I think he calls it.
Yeah.
I think that one of the reasons I choose to work in the language of myth is that I do think that if you're going to have a society that works, there has to be some commonality of language. You can disagree about the use of the terms. As long as you have some common terms that you can use, you need to have a notion of justice that you all more or less agree on before you can have a reasonably good argument about whether something is justice or whether it's injustice. And it's the failure of those common understandings and, in fact, the loss of faith that such common understandings can be reached that I see as being a serious problem.
This is Richard Slotkin. We're going to be back for another couple minutes. In just a moment, Bill Russell. He is with me. I'm Paula Gordon. We're all going to be back. Please do be with us.